Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are in the midst of election 2020 with a record number of ballots already turned in, millions more expected in the coming days. So big election day, get out the vote energy is really spread out over an entire month, and it seems to be working early on. The California Secretary of State says more than 1.5 million ballots have been cast as of yesterday, and that's about 7% of registered voters in California. So compare that to just 150,000 at the same point back in 2016, and you can see what a big difference it is just 4 years later. Coming up, we'll dig into the changes for this election system, the demographics of the early vote, and how it all differs from prior election cycles. But first up, some of the ballots cast in recent days have landed in controversial drop boxes placed in some areas of California by leaders of the state's Republican Party who vow to keep them going. California election officials say the boxes are illegal and need to go. Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rudd joins us this morning to help us understand the status of these boxes and what the two sides are saying about it, what will happen next. Scott, this is now seriously a national story.
Absolutely. I mean, even just a couple of days ago when it first started to sort of break, you know, you saw national outlets, you know, jump on this coverage. And I actually spoke to I reached out to the Secretary of State's office, and their spokesperson said, you know, this is one of those stories where, you know, I immediately just got 25, you know, requests for comment in my inbox right away. And so, yeah, I mean, this is something that absolutely is making, you know, making headlines across the country. And people are watching it wondering, okay, you know, this is already an election that is pretty unusual. I mean, we're in a pandemic. We're you know, relying much more on mail-in voting. And so a party setting up their own ballot boxes, as if this election wasn't already kind of crazy enough, it's now, you know, got another element to it.
So how did the boxes get out there? At this point this morning, do we know how many boxes are out there? Because I understand there's many more than what was first reported.
So that remains a mystery, just how many boxes there are. I have not seen an official count. And the only thing that we've seen, the latest update, and I believe it was a story in the out of Orange County, the spokesperson for the Republican Party indicated that there are over 100 of these boxes. But at the same time, I mean, they didn't specify how many, and they were pretty vague on it. And that is, it is the party, but it is just one source. So, you know, it's still unclear how many boxes there are. The spokesperson for the party says over 100, didn't specify how many. There's also questions about, you know, how many counties these boxes are in. They confirmed 3 counties, Fresno, Orange, and Los Angeles. But they also indicated that there are at least 2 more counties. But again, the party refused to say which counties. It's unclear why. You know, maybe they didn't want to draw more attention to it, more scrutiny. But that remains unclear.
You mentioned the Secretary of State's office. What is the state saying about these boxes? That they're illegal, right?
Yeah, the Secretary of State's office says, yeah, these are illegal. These are not official authorized ballot boxes. And to jump back and give a little bit of an overview, you know, these boxes appeared. They appear to be these green boxes, and some of them at first had signs that said that they were official ballot boxes. And that was something that immediately the Secretary of State's office took issue with. The party has since come back and said, look, you know, we removed these signs that say official. That yesterday, the general counsel for the party said that that was likely the result of an overzealous volunteer who put these signs on them. So they said that they removed those signs and they're not going to be using them moving forward. But they said that they're going to keep using these boxes. And Harmeet Dhillon, who's a civil rights attorney and also a Republican National Committee woman from California, she indicated that she feels that this is the state's effort to try to suppress voters, especially voters from the Republican Party. Here's what she had to say.
We have every interest and intention of delivering these ballots so that they will be counted, whoever's ballots they are. That's the point. We want the election to be free and fair. The letter from the Democrat Secretary of State is a voter suppression effort aimed at intimidating California Republican Party officials and volunteers from gathering and delivering ballots.
And so, you know, this is it's an interesting claim saying that, you know, these boxes are totally legitimate and claiming that the Secretary of State is trying to box out people from voting when the Secretary of State has been very vocal in public about trying to get people out to vote. So interesting sort of messages there.
If you're a member of either party or no party at all, for that matter, why would you want to choose one of these boxes? Why would you not want to bring, if you're, you know, if you're really concerned about it being counted, bringing it to an official drop box, to a, you know, to a place, to a voting center that might be near you, or popping it in the mail?
So the Republican Party says that, you know, they're putting up these boxes because they feel like some voters may not be reached, and some voters may feel apprehensive about putting their ballot in the mail, even though mail-in balloting has shown to be, very reliable. The party is arguing, you know, some people may just not feel comfortable. And ballot collection in California, what some people refer to as ballot harvesting, mm-hmm. which is, you know, somewhat of a pejorative term, is legal in California. There are certain requirements that you have to meet to do it, but you can collect. Someone can go in, or a voter can hand over their ballot to someone else to then be delivered to a registrar. But you know, there are certain requirements that have to be met. The Republican Party says that they're meeting these requirements, and they're saying that they put up these boxes because, you know, many of them are in churches or in areas where voters will likely know who either the pastor is at a church or a business owner, and that there's a level of trust there. So the voter can hand it over, know that it's not just going into a post office box, and feel as though that there's a level of trust there to hand over that ballot.
You mentioned the removal of the terminology official on these boxes. What are some of the other concessions, if I guess for lack of a better term, that the Republican Party is agreeing to in the wake of the Secretary of State's cease and desist letter?
So they've said, in addition to removing those official labels, they're saying they're only putting the boxes inside establishments, so either mm-hmm. businesses or churches, not on public sidewalks, even though there are photos floating around on social media that showed some of these boxes on public sidewalks. The party is saying that they're not doing that, that any boxes that are out there will be inside a building. They're also saying that they've assigned volunteer staff or paid staff to each of these boxes to essentially monitor them, to ensure that voters are using them correctly, to answer questions, and that those volunteer staff will then be responsible for delivering those ballots to registrars. And the party is saying that they'll be doing that within 72 hours of a ballot being dropped off, which is the requirement by law. However, they're also kind of holding firm on certain things. They've acknowledged that, you know, when someone hands over one of these ballots, depending on who you ask, what's required or at least ideal by law is that the voter sign it and then the individual who is returning the ballot also sign it, and they list their relationship to the voter. However, the party is saying that the letter of the law doesn't necessarily disqualify a vote, a ballot, if it's not signed by both parties. And that's important because, you know, if someone does happen to drop off the ballot in a box, maybe didn't sign it, or if someone who's delivering the ballot doesn't sign it, doesn't mean that the ballot's automatically disqualified. And Tom Hiltach, who is the counsel for the state Republican Party, spoke to this issue yesterday during a press call.
The Secretary of State is simply wrong when he says that a ballot dropped into a box must be signed by either the voter or the person who's received it before it can be delivered to an elections official.
So is it a best practices thing? Like, this is the best way to do it, but,
you know, from what my understanding of what I've heard from the Secretary of State is they would argue that it has to be done, that it is required by law. But California is pretty forgiving when it comes to if there are issues with the ballot. You know, say, for example, if a signature doesn't match, or, you know, the state is very forgiving in terms of not automatically just, you know, sort of disqualifying a ballot. They do want to reach out to voters, want to ensure that, you know, it is a legitimate vote and that they correct any issues if possible. So it seems like it may fall into that category where they're not going to discard the ballot if it's not signed, but there may be some follow-up that has to be done in order to ensure that it's valid.
Scott, we have a ticking clock, right? The party is supposed to have these boxes, according to the state anyway, removed by today.
That's what the cease and desist letter from the state, the Secretary of State, said, that they had to remove these boxes and then also hand over any ballots that had been cast to county officials. And the Republican Party has made clear they're not going to do that. So it's now all eyes on the Secretary of State to see what their next move is. Is the party's, what they've signaled they're planning to do, whether you call them concessions or just their plan of action moving forward, is that sufficient for the Secretary of State to say, okay, you know, this looks fine, maybe can you make some of these tweaks? Or are they going to say, no, this is not, we still believe that these ballot boxes are not legal? And they indicate, or they said explicitly, that all legal options are on the table if these boxes weren't removed, if the state party didn't comply. So we'll see what that means moving forward. Again, it's all eyes on the Secretary of State for what their move's going to be.
Elections are run on a very local level, the county level. And I'm wondering, the communities in which these boxes have appeared, has there been any kind of pushback?
There has. You know, almost immediately when I called the Fresno County Republican Party, I asked, you know, what's up with these boxes? Have you, you know, how many are there? They said, well, we actually have removed all of them. And I couldn't get a clear answer as to why, but this was just as a lot of the controversy was starting to kick up. And the Fresno County Registrar of Voters, Brandy Orth, was very forthright with me during a phone call, expressing concerns about, you know, these ballot boxes being around her county.
Well, the one risk is you don't know that they're actually going to find their way to me. California law states that if the voter is going to allow someone else to return their ballot for them, the voter must sign on the back of the envelope the name of the person they're designating and the relationship to them. I don't believe that that was being done in this other unauthorized process. And then, of course, whatever ballot is dropped off or given to a different person, it must be in the hands of an election official within 3 days. And so I have no verification of that.
So, again, that issue of delivery time of signatures, expressing concern from the voter, from the election official side, saying, you know, we don't know, you know, if these steps are being followed. The party, again, though, is saying that they will meet all the requirements and what they're doing is following the letter of the law. I would also just like to add that I confirmed with the state Republican Party that some establishments that did have these boxes inside of them have requested them to be removed.
Oh.
Because they're fearing controversy from it. So they initially said, sure, we can have some of these boxes, saw a lot of the dust up and said, you know, this isn't for us. You can please remove them.
Is that the group of churches? There was a group of churches that were kind of surprised by all of everything that was happening?
Yeah. I confirmed with at least two churches that ballot boxes had been removed, these ballot boxes that were, you know, supplied by the state GOP. But there's also this sort of subplot that I've, you know, been looking at, maybe dove down the rabbit hole, I'm not sure, but as part of the Secretary of State's cease and desist letter, they included attachments showing sort of posts on social media and other concerns being expressed publicly about these boxes to kind of support showing, look, there's these concerns out there. And one of them was a post from the Palmdale mayor. And he gave this list of churches in the area and said, hey, if you're looking to drop off your ballot, go ahead and swing by these churches. I've talked with the local ministerial group. They're all for it. I reached out to all of these churches, and some I didn't get through to, but a number of them I did. And a number of them were caught off guard by this completely because they said they weren't consulted about this. They don't have ballot boxes there. A couple that two that did have ballot boxes were, they said, you know, we had no idea this would be controversial. But my understanding is they all got cease and desist letters. So they sort of were caught off guard, especially the ones who had no connection to this or no awareness. They suddenly got a cease and desist letter from the Registrar of Voters in Los Angeles. And so they're saying, whoa, okay, it's telling us to, you know, by law, stop doing something. And we had no idea that we were caught up in it.
Wow. Well, we do have ballot tracking in California now. So I guess, you know, if you've used one of these boxes, you know, you can find out whether your ballot made it to the end destination.
And that's what the Secretary of State's office is strongly encouraging, especially anyone who dropped off their ballot in one of these boxes and has concerns, or just in general. You know, if you mm-hmm. want to see where your ballot is during the process, there is a step-by-step sort of tracker, and it's Where's My Ballot? And if you look at that, if you Google it online with Secretary of State for California, you will easily find the website, and you can follow your ballot each and every step of the way.
Right on. Cap Radio State Government Reporter Scott Rodd. We're going to continue following this story and following you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Up next, who's doing all of the early voting and what does it mean? We have an expert in to let you know. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And our focus today is the 2020 elections. You know, 1.5 million and counting. That's how many ballots have been returned in California. And the general election is just under 3 weeks away. That is by far a record. For comparison, in 2016, at the same time, about 150,000 ballots were cast for the general election. In Sacramento County, 80,000 ballots have been cast so far this year compared to just 2,000 in 2016. These figures all released by the Secretary of State's office just yesterday. So the numbers are rising as we sit here. What's driving the big numbers this year? You know, fear over potential voting issues, perhaps concerns over the integrity of the voting process. Who is voting early and why? And what are the next few weeks going to look like? Well, Paul Mitchell is the vice president of Political Data, Inc. His company is a bipartisan voter data company. So he collects this voter information from all 58 counties and then provides the analytics to both the Democratic and Republican parties. Paul joins us today to help us understand some of what he's tracking this election season. Paul, great to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I guess it's an understatement to say an election year like none other.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely, they always say this is the most important election. I don't know about that, but it's definitely the craziest election. And some breaking news, we're at over 2 million now. So we'll be putting out data on that later on today, but we're going to be over 2 million the next time people see the reports.
Wow. Over 2 million cast now. Did you expect this kind of turnout for early voting?
No, it's actually... traditionally, there's a couple things. One is that traditionally voters, that first week that ballots are mailed out, they might wait to the weekend, they might sit around their kitchen table and fill out their ballot. You start to see real numbers coming in usually the middle of the second week. And we've been tracking this data like intensively for years, ever for about 10 years now, I've been doing ballot tracking for every election. And we've seen this rapid escalation of these ballot returns way earlier than before. For a frame of reference, that first Friday, we usually don't even release the tracker because usually numbers are around 8,000 to 12,000 ballots by that first Friday statewide. And we were at over 250,000 on that Friday. So right now with the numbers we're at, we're probably at 4 to 5 times higher than prior records in terms of early vote. And the real question is, what does this mean for the full length of the 30-day window?
I feel like I'm behind the times with my ballot still sitting on the coffee table. I got to get on it, apparently.
Yeah, if you haven't put it on Instagram yet, then your friends are really concerned about you.
Do we know who is doing this early voting at this point?
Yeah, so the first thing that a lot of people are seeing is the high number of Democratic voters in this early pool. And that's striking to a lot of people because traditionally it's Republicans that are voting earlier and Democrats that are voting later. The underlying demographic nature of it is that traditionally, the people who vote earliest are the most stable homeowners, older people who vote by mail regularly and are used to it, high turnout voters. So you're looking at wider, more conservative, more Republican, more suburban voters. What's interesting is this election cycle, we're still seeing a lot of those same subgroups. So right now, you know, the seniors are 45% about of the ballots being returned when they're only, you know, they're less than a quarter of the actual electorate. So we have a older, more stable, more high turnout population returning their ballots. It's just that a lot of Democrats who would have voted later anyway or voted voting earlier. So the issue, the question going forward is, are we going to start seeing less likely voters returning their ballots?
Mm-hmm.
For a frame of reference, we at PDI provide modeling and targeting data to all the campaigns. And we have our likely voter universes. Only 1% of the vote that's come in so far is not in one of our likely voter universes. So we really have an open question still about whether this is representative of a true surge in turnout or just the same people voting earlier than they would have otherwise.
So it could trickle off dramatically as we get closer to Election Day?
Yeah, a couple things could happen. Is one, we could see this kind of stall out where the people who were going to vote have voted and the people who aren't going to vote still haven't. And the second thing is we're expecting to see a shift where in polling, a lot of Democrats have been saying for months they're going to vote super early. They're going to put it on Instagram and Facebook, and it was going to be like this, you know, kind of movement essentially around voting by mail. And among conservatives and Republicans, it was, I'm going to vote at the polls. You know, my party or my president's telling me that vote by mail is rigged, and so I'm going to go vote in person. And that dynamic we've never seen before, that like basically people of both parties are virtue signaling based on when they vote, which is strange to those of us who have been following this for decades.
Yeah, the how you vote has become so politicized. It's fascinating. You reported via tweet yesterday that Latino voters are voting at incredibly high rates. What's behind that?
So Latino voters are still underperforming in terms of a share of the electorate that has cast ballots. They're 26% of the electorate, but they're only 17% of the votes that have been returned so far. However, in raw numbers, over a quarter million Latinos have returned their ballots. In fact, right now it's over 300,000 Latinos have returned their ballots. 300,000 would be higher than what we traditionally would expect for overall turnout at this point.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a sense of the scaling of this, that there are literally more Latinos in California who have voted by mail by now than the same time in 2016 had voted by mail in total.
And all of the numbers that we're talking about right now are California-based. What do we know about how different California is right now in terms of this early voting compared to the rest of the nation? Nevada, our next-door neighbor, how's it going there?
Well, there's a couple different lenses to look at this through. One is California was much more prepared for this heavy shift to vote by mail. In the primary, 75% of our votes were cast by mail. Even if we didn't have this pandemic, we were on schedule to send 17.5 million ballots out in California. Mm. There are other states like Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and Utah that are all or almost entirely all vote by mail as well. And so a lot of these states were better prepared for this. Then you have other states that maybe have always had a vote by mail system where it's excuse based, meaning you have to have an excuse saying like, I'm disabled, or I'm going to be on vacation, or I'm not living there right now. And those states are the ones that are really struggling in terms of trying to either change to a system or implement greater vote by mail options. But overall, nationally, we are seeing some of the same issue with, you know, a lot of high turnout among Democrats early and a lot of Republicans saying that they're going to vote late. And I feel there might be some misinterpretation of that, that people are overselling the idea of a big Democratic wave so far. We have to be able to see the totality of the vote before we can really determine that.
We keep hearing about this potential red mirage on election night, followed by a blue wave. What is your data telling you?
The blue shift.
Blue shift, rather. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's traditionally in California this thing called the blue shift, which is earlier voters, like I said, demographically older, whiter, more established homeowners, that stuff. As a result, their votes when they come in, they're the ones counted first because they can process those ballots before election day and report them on election night. So the first data that goes up right after the polls close at 8 o'clock, we in the business call it the 801s. The 801s represent those earliest votes that were cast. And generally, a Republican candidate will be at the high water mark because of the votes that had come in so far. Then over the course of counting ballots, you start to see the Democrat gain and gain and gain as those later voters, the college students, the people that registered to vote the same day of the election, the people who held onto the ballots the longest. As those later voters' ballots are counted, you start to see the shift towards Democrats.
And we really saw that a couple of years ago where we had a number of congressional races in California that were either too close to call or had been called for the GOP candidate, and then it shifted.
Yeah, so we've seen that repeatedly in California, this shift towards the Democratic candidate as those different subgroups' ballots are counted. This year, people are saying, well, maybe it's going to be the opposite. I think that might be an overread of this. I think that this is going to be pretty balanced out. I think in California, we probably aren't going to have the blue shift anymore, at least not this election, that the election results that come on election night, maybe the final numbers that come by Wednesday morning, they're pretty much going to hold, I think, because of this deliberate move by a lot of high propensity active Democrats to vote early and a lot of high propensity active Republicans to vote late.
Paul, in your mind, what's the biggest unknown in this year's voting process?
Well, I mean, you could categorize it as different sets of unknowns. In California, our unknown is, you know, are those Republicans that haven't voted yet still going to vote? Are they going to vote at the polls? Are they going to be dissuaded when they get to the polls and there might be long lines, or they're told that they have to vote with a provisional ballot because they didn't bring their mail-in ballot? So there's a lot of unknowns in California. Nationally, I think there are greater unknowns around how this transition to more mail voting is going to work in other states. Other states, especially certain key states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, they can't even start processing the ballots until election day or election night, depending on the law. So we might have a situation where we don't know yet, but we might have a situation where we're going to be waiting a week or 10 days or 2 weeks for some key states that might swing the presidential race to actually, you know, finish counting their ballots. So there's a lot of unknowns. And then, of course, we were talking about it before we went on air. You always have to think about this October surprise. And,
right.
You know, and this year, again, more news today, that the October surprise is more like an advent calendar where we're getting one more every day as we get through the election cycle. So, I think you could stay up all night, every night, just worrying about what the next surprise is going to be this year.
Vote tracking is new. Is that a California only thing?
Well, I like to say that we at Political Data really inspired a lot of people to do this kind of work. It used to be something that only the campaigns would see. So if you were a big campaign and you wanted to see as those ballots are coming in, PDI and other private data companies would allow you to see that basically only for the paid customers. We at PDI, starting in 2014, started making this public and every year started generating more and more information and putting it out there. And that started a wave. There's a professor in Florida, Michael McDonald, who has taken this work and done it nationally and does a real effective job at kind of telling the story of what's happening in a lot of other states. And he uses our data for his California piece. But yeah, it is something that is relatively new. The sophistication of it, the ability to drill down into smaller jurisdictions. You can literally just check like your local school board and see how many Latino Democrats voted or something like that. That is unprecedented and something that is really new.
Well, Paul Mitchell is Vice President of Political Data, Inc. Paul, I just love the Advent calendar October surprise analogy. That is that's really how it's been for the past couple of months, I guess.
Paul, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for being here today and giving us some insight as to where we stand in the election right now.
Happy to. Thanks for having me.
And as we've mentioned, California is breaking all kinds of mail-in voting records. We just heard from Paul that it's now over 2 million votes cast at this point in the state of California. And so how does the mail-in system affect voter turnout? It would appear early on that it really helps it quite a bit, but Paul said maybe that'll slow down as we head toward Election Day. To get the latest studies on all of that, we turn to Eric McGee. He's a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, and welcome to Insight, Eric. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So what was the goal? You have a new report out. The PPIC has this report out that looks at the effects of vote by mail. What was the goal of this report?
Well, so as the session you just had with Paul suggested, there's all this voting by mail that's happening this fall. That's part of a conscious effort by the state to make it easier to vote without having to go in person and risk coronavirus exposure, right? So everybody's getting a vote by mail ballot in the whole state. It turns out there's 15 counties in the state that have already shifted to something kind of like this system. That is, everybody gets a vote by mail ballot by default. There's a smaller number of more consolidated in-person options. And so we looked at whether and sort of what had happened in the experience with those 15 counties. Did they, what kind of turnout changes occurred when they adopted this this new system of voting, since it's kind of like what people are going to be using in the fall.
Yeah, so you had some existing data from places that had already shifted that way, including Sacramento County.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, our data came from Paul Mitchell's outfit. So and what we did was we looked at sort of the overall turnout levels. We looked at people by sort of their preference for whether they wanted to vote by mail or wanted to vote in person. That's still kind of indicated in the file, even though everybody's getting a vote by mail ballot by default. So looking at sort of what their preferences were in advance and then also what their demographic profile was.
Yeah. So
and we found that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah. What did you find? Which groups are more likely to, I guess, have trouble with the transition to vote by mail?
Well, yeah. So the first of all, the top line takeaway is that under this system in these 15 counties, turnout has generally increased. Especially for people who would have been in-person voters in the past. They might still be in-person voters in this new system, but the new system kind of helps them overcome some hurdles and increases turnout just a little bit. But then drilling down into sort of different demographic groups, we found that there are some groups that have at some point in time had some signs of trouble with the transition where their turnout didn't increase like it did for everybody else, or actually maybe went down a little bit. So this would be people who register as wanting their ballot materials in a foreign language, Latinos, Asian Americans, young people, new voters. These are all groups that didn't always have trouble with this transition. So this new system has been used in a number of elections at this point, but they didn't always have that trouble, but they sometimes had that trouble. And to us, that was a flag that you should be concerned about that group, and you should do extra outreach to try and ensure that they know what the new system is all about, know how to make the transition, and that there's nothing sort of, there's no balls dropped along the way.
Mm-hmm. Eric, the younger voters really surprises me that they're not able to transition, because it seems like it would be the older people who were, you know, set in their ways. This is how we vote. This is the way we go about it. The younger people, it's new to them. So switching over to mail-in shouldn't be a problem.
Well, you might think that would be true. One thing is that the younger voters do tend to be Are they more likely to be in-person voters in the first place than senior voters are? But also, I mean, as Paul was talking about in the previous session, the senior voters are also just more loyal and dedicated voters. People tend to become more consistent about voting as they get older, and so they can kind of persevere through anything that seems new or different or unusual or not quite what they were expecting. And I think if there is an explanation for it, for both the young people and for the new registrants sometimes having trouble, that would be the explanation.
Does your report focus in at all on where the trouble spots are likely to be?
So we weren't able to beyond the demographic groups, we weren't able to drill down to specific geographic parts of the state, in part because what we were doing was comparing these 15 counties to the rest of the state that didn't make the transition. So we didn't really look at the geographic dimension to it in quite the same way. But we were able to sort of lay out this kind of demographic profile of people who might have a little more trouble with the transition.
Mm-hmm. So we have these 2 million ballots that are already in. What did your report say about the timing of ballot returns? Is this what we're witnessing way different than what happened with the data that you had?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about the system is everybody gets this vote-by-mail ballot by default. The people who decide to mail in their ballot actually do it kind of in an even, steady pace throughout the pre-election period. So the ballots are mailed out 29 days before the election, and then people kind of just return them in a trickle. The people who are actually mailing them in, as opposed to a number of people carry their vote-by-mail ballot in and drop it off in person. So those who actually mail it in tend to do it in a sort of a trickle over the course of the campaign, that last month of the campaign. So what we're seeing right now is very extraordinary. It's people who are mailing in their ballots really early. They're getting that ballot, and they're just saying, pop it in the mail right away, which is not necessarily what we've seen before. What we've seen before is more of a steady pace.
Mm-hmm. And again, your report shows that the effects of an increased vote by mail system is not party specific. That the ships sort of rise, all ships rise, right? When the tide comes.
Yeah.
In.
So there's no sign that it has, and this is consistent not just in California, but in other states that people have looked at with similar kind of question, does it affect the partisanship of the outcome? And the answer is no. Now, of course, we are in a very different environment this election. All kinds of things could be different. We do have this interesting sort of politicization of the timing of voting, where, you know, Democrats feel like they want to vote early and vote by mail, like actually mailing in the ballot, and then Republicans want to go in person and vote that way. You know, will that, The thing that we really care about in the end is how many ballots are counted, right? And how many ballots from Republicans versus how many ballots from Democrats are actually counted. It doesn't really matter for the count when they're voted, just that they are counted. Mm-hmm. So what we don't know yet, and what is still kind of very much a question mark, is whether this pattern of the timing of the voting is going to affect how many votes actually end up being counted.
Eric McGee, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, thank you so much for sharing the info you have on vote-by-mail trends with us this morning. We appreciate that.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, still ahead, if the never-ending stream of political ads, yard signs, and snarky social media posts have you looking for a distraction, we may have just the thing for you, a local photographer who sees art in Sacramento's everyday people and places reimagining what's right in front of you all the time. Also, shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag Ask Insight. We'd love to hear your voting plans and how it's gone for you so far. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And these days, we all have a lot on our minds. If you just listened to the last three segments, you know why, especially this year with the election and all the difficult news, the COVID pandemic, the wildfires. It can be a lot. And slowing down can be tough if it's not in your DNA. But there's a guy here in Sacramento with a passion for taking the time to stop and see the beauty all around us, even during these chaotic times. Enoch Ku is 34 years old. He's an actor and professional wedding photographer who is bringing the beauty of Sacramento to light through his project called Ordinary Sacramento. It's a collection of photos he posts on Instagram of things you may not realize are beautiful, because it's the whole stop and smell the roses, right? You just walk right past it and you don't even see it. Enoch Ku is with us today, and thanks for joining us to explain the passion behind your project.
Hey, thank you so much for having me today.
So since this is radio and your medium is photos, let's start with you describing some of those photos that you take around town.
Living out here in the suburbs, one of the first things that really hit you just as I'm wandering around the city is the suburban landscapes. I love how much green is in our city, the trees, in particular, cypress trees. Before this project, I didn't really have an eye or even notice the green landscapes around me. But now that I've been kind of wandering my neighborhood, I've just been seeing it sounds so ordinary, but yeah, the trees and the bushes and
We are the city of trees.
yeah, exactly. We are the city of trees.
And so when you say cypress, you mean those Italian cypress with it form almost like a wall?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so let's say you walk up on a string of cypress trees, how do you then couch that through the lens to give it that unique vision that you have, this ordinary Sacramento vision?
First, it's usually I'm walking and I notice it, and then I'm just caught up in this moment of, wow, this is really cool, like really, really amazing. And I try to find that kind of scene or what makes this thing that I'm coming across beautiful to me. And I try to hone in on that. And so it's kind of just like walking around, observing, looking at the light and looking how the sun is hitting the subject. It's also, making sure that I'm, as I'm wandering around, some people might stop me and wonder why they're I'm taking a picture of, a tree. And so sometimes it's stopping and saying, hey, I'm just a local photographer. Just trying to capture some ordinary moments. And sometimes they're just really confused. Sometimes they ask a lot of questions, but yeah, usually stopping and observing.
It's like when someone's standing on a corner and looking up, you'll notice that people start looking up like, what?
Yeah.
What's up there?
100%. Yeah. It's funny because in the beginning, I'll be taking a picture of a really cool looking mailbox with these flames on it that I've lived near this in the mailbox for so long. And for the first time, it was revealed to me that it was there. And I stopped to take some pictures and someone came out and they were very aggressive with like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And trying to explain like, oh, I'm, trying to slow down and take pictures of beautiful, ordinary things was really hard for them to kind of understand or get. And
sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, now it's just, I just say, I'm a student taking a photography class And then they're just super kind and super open to me taking pictures.
That's good. Yeah. So you have that ability to transform them, as do your photos. And I'm wondering what this sort of secret magic sauce is that's behind your ability to see these things. And it sounds like you get yourself in a mental state to be able to walk around and see things, because so many of us have all kinds of stuff going through our minds. We're thinking about what we have to do at work, yeah. What, you know, our plans for the weekend, when we used to have plans for the weekend, and stuff like that. So how do you clear all that out? Is it like a meditation you go through to be able to see these things that are right in front of you?
Actually, I would say for me in particular, I'm more rushed and busy in my life. You know, being a photographer and actor, I'm always constantly thinking about the future. And because I'm constantly thinking about the future, you know, anxiety, just worry about the next job, the next meeting, the next, you know, this and that. And so taking my camera and actually going on a walk and being present and unhurried and just not giving into the hustle and bustle of, you know, that life, that is the meditation in and of itself. And so it's weird because, you know, I'll come to a scene that I really appreciate and really enjoy and I find beauty. My mind lingers to the thought that I was born for this moment, or I, you know, 5 minutes, I could have walked out of my house 10 minutes later and missed this scene. But wow. For whatever reason, God or his providence, I'm here in this moment to be able to share in its beauty, and just kind of capture it and share it with the world.
Enoch, you call our hurried lives, what is it, hurry sickness?
Hurry sickness. Yeah
hurry exactly. Sickness. And you describe one thing that really rang true with me is if you're coming up to a stop sign and there's more than one lane of traffic, and one of the lanes of traffic has, you know, three or four cars sitting behind the red light. And one of the lanes is either empty or just has one car. It's my tendency to slide into the lane that has the fewer cars. Because,
totally, I understand, yeah.
Because I'm trying to reach pole position. Like, I want to get, you know, I want to be the first out of the gate.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
And we sort of go through our lives with that constant preset notion of that's how we need to do things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
grocery store lines, all that kind of stuff.
Grocery store lines, freeway traffic driving.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in a. Personally, for me, we're all in a. You know, for me, it was driving. I drive back to and from San Francisco often for my job, and it was actually in traffic where kind of the frustrations of, you know, anxiety, where it just kind of all boiled over, and it was actually in traffic where I began to see that, you know, the type of person that I wasn't liking the type of person I was becoming because of just this addiction to hurry and rushing around. And so, yeah, I'm kind of just wanting to make some choices to slow down. One was driving slower in the slow lane on the freeway, which is so hard for me.
It is difficult.
The toughest thing. Yeah. It's so, you know, I just want to go into the fast lane and go get to my business, but doing that, actually taking the long route home on a drive, kind of the side streets. I avoid main streets often just because, hey, there's something new I might be able to see. And so,
you know, there are studies that say you're smarter because of that, that people that take different routes instead of the same route every single time score higher on intelligence tests.
Wow.
Yeah. So there you go. There's a little nugget. Hey.
I hope you're listening, Mom and Dad.
Hey, speaking of your mom and dad, I understand that your ability to sort of get a handle on this hurried sickness has helped you communicate better with your dad.
Yeah. So I've come to learn, like, as I'm doing this project of just slowing down and observing the world around me, it's begun to become a thing of observing the interior life. And so, you know, especially during this time of staying at home and being around loved ones, it's been interesting to kind of turn that observation into inward into my relationships my personal relationships. And so, you know, being an Asian American male, growing up in America, I've been looking for resources to find about my relationship with my dad, just to kind of see the depth and, you know, figure things out. And so I turned the camera on him. Mm. And I began to take pictures of him and began to observe him and, you know, his daily life and his routine. And it's been really cool to kind of see the breakthrough in relationship with him, in the sense that I'm beginning to understand him more, communicate with him, or try to communicate with him more. And so that's actually a project that I'm going to be working on right now, of kind of, I guess, of my ordinary dad.
I love it. So speaking of hurried sickness, I have 1 minute on the clock in front of me. So I constantly, during Insight, have this clock that I have to follow. So I have to wrap it up here. But I do want to mention that Cap Radio's photojournalist Andrew Nixon has put together a digital profile on you, Enoch Koo's Ordinary Sacramento Project. So Andrew followed you around town and gives everyone a great glimpse of the photos that you've taken. And you can watch the digital piece right now at capradio.org, or you can follow Enoch's work on Instagram. Just search Ordinary Sacramento. Enoch, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Yeah. Is there any way I can share real quick of a gallery that I'll be hosting?
I can't, because I only have 10 seconds more, but they can get that on the website.
All right. No problem.
Right on. Enoch, thank you so much. That is Insight for this week. We look forward to catching up with you Monday morning. I'm Randall White.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.